Welcome to the podcast series for HAP Heart and Circulatory Physiology. I'm your host, Kara Hansel-Keehan. Today we'll discuss the article by Memes et al. Titled, Parental Vitamin D Deficiency During Pregnancy is Associated with Increased Blood Pressure in Offspring via PANCS1 Hypermethylation. This article published online October 21st, 2016. Joining me today are Associate Editor Nancy Kanagi, Lead Author Rudolf DeBoer, and Content Expert Mingyu Liang. Let's get started.
Thank you, Kara. I'm excited to talk about this study today by Rudolf DeBoer and his co-workers that reports some fascinating results that help to illuminate the developing field of epigenetics. So in this study, both mothers and fathers, rats, were given a diet deficient in vitamin D for 10 weeks prior to mating and then throughout the pregnancy. And this resulted in male offspring that had elevated blood pressure that was accompanied by a decrease in expression of the endothelial protein PANCS1. Now, the loss of PANCS1 was further associated with a diminished endothelium-dependent vasodilation in aortic segments. While some of these observations are still somewhat associative, the findings are very exciting and highlight the potential effects of maternal and paternal diets on offspring genotypes and phenotypes. So to open our discussion, I would first invite Rudolf to tell us a little bit about the inspiration for choosing vitamin D as a potential dietary influence on offspring cardiovascular physiology.
Yes, thank you very much for that and for the opportunity to highlight our paper. So the idea of this study actually stems from the observation that in Holland, the country where this study was conducted, there's actually excess cardiovascular risk in people who were born during the end of the Second World War or shortly thereafter. And it has been hypothesized that that is explained by the parents that survived the war, that had to live through a famine that was present at the end of the war in 1944 and 45. And we know at that time, many mothers and also parents were deficient for various nutrients, including vitamins. And again, it has been associated that people who were born from these deficient parents have excess cardiovascular risk, have excess in the prevalence of hypercholesterolemia and also hypertension. And that is actually the initial observation that we based this study upon.
So thinking specifically about the nutrient vitamin D, it reminds me that not only were these post-war population deficient in vitamins and other nutrients, but even today we have an entire population that gets vitamin D deprived for part of the year due to the overcast conditions in what I like to call the gray zone, where there isn't very much sunshine and therefore not very much vitamin D in a group of the population. Could you address the specific aspects of vitamin D?
Thank you for bringing this up. And here in Holland, we know all about this gray zone, unfortunately. But I think it's important to realize that as you say, globally, vitamin D deficiency is really amongst the most prevalent deficiency, nutritional deficiencies that is around. But here in this study, the level of deficiency was really very profound.
And if we switch over a little bit to Mingyu. Mingyu, I know that you've had some recent studies looking at protein content of diet as an influence on offspring cardiovascular health. Now, have you looked at any dietary components that are as focused as vitamin D? Or do you think that specific dietary nutrients compared to sort of general classes of nutrients play a bigger role, a lesser role, an unknown role in epigenetic influences?
So thank you, Nancy, for bringing that up. The study that we recently published was actually on two diets that we feed our rat models. The two diets are actually quite different from each other. But in previous studies that my colleagues had published, they did look at specific dietary components. In those studies, what they found was the protein source or the type of proteins that was in the diet was actually quite important in determining blood pressure phenotype. We are actually just in the process of looking at those specific components in terms of the effects on offspring blood pressure phenotype. Those studies are ongoing.
You know, you bring up a very interesting point, which both of you have mentioned now, and that is that both the paternal and the maternal diets were altered. What I think is so fascinating is that I would have speculated in a naive way that the maternal diet would have a much greater impact on offspring outcomes than paternal diet, because of course you also affect the uterine environment. Could both of you comment on differential influences of paternal versus maternal dietary influences?
In our study, we depleted both the mothers and the fathers, so we haven't tested it ourselves. But the reason to do so is that from literature we know that there's ample experience that also paternal deficiencies bring about numerous changes in DNA methylation. It's been done in microarray analyses and all kinds of studies. So apparently also deficiencies in the father are being passed on to the offspring. But again, in our study, we didn't address this issue specifically.
Nancy, I'm very happy that you brought up this question, because it's actually a very important and also scientifically very exciting question in the field of epigenetics at the moment. So there are actually studies in which people have shown the changing just the paternal diet can have an impact on offspring health. There was a study on changing the paternal diet in terms of protein content. And really interesting thing is what they found is that what's mediating that sort of transgenerational effect is actually something in the sperms. And it's actually most likely the trans factors in the sperms, including non-coding RNA and other things in the sperms. In terms of maternal exposure, as you said, it's kind of difficult to distinguish the exposure before and during pregnancy. There are ways to do that. It's just somewhat complicated. So the study that we just recently published, I think last year, in hypertension, what we did there was we did embryo transfer. So basically, we actually take the single cell embryos and put them into surrogate mothers. And so in that way, we can control what the embryos are exposed to before pregnancy, or the germ cells exposed to before pregnancy, and what the embryos are exposed to during pregnancy. So there are ways to actually separate them. But these are actually very exciting things that are going on in epigenetic research now.
It's a fascinating field and obviously changing very rapidly. Mingyu, do you have any questions or discussion points that you would like to bring up?
It is a very new topic. There are many, many unknowns and challenges in the field, but I think it is a very exciting direction that's really worth exploring, both at a mechanistic scientific level, and also my own interest at the moment is more in the precision medicine and translational and clinical area. Epigenetics is very important in both levels. Another sort of general comment is the transgenerational aspect of epigenetic inheritance. It's a very open question, and there are debates even on, for example, how many generations you have to go before you can demonstrate transgenerational inheritance. And a lot of people in the field believe you have to go 3 generations at least. In my opinion, you can actually go just 2 generations if the experiment was done in a specific way. And so these are very topical and exciting things that we are studying.
There was one other aspect of this study that I thought would be interesting to talk about, and that was the methods that you use for looking at methylation and interrogating the methylation. And you used 3 different methods, Rudolf, and only used those genes that were shown by 3 different approaches to have changes in methylation. And I think this really points out one of the pitfalls in the field. It's difficult to get really convincing positive data, and doing these robust studies is important. So perhaps both of you could comment on your feelings on interrogating the genome in looking for these epigenetic changes.
There is no consensus in how to analyze epigenetic data. Also, if you look at very large scale genome-wide methylation studies or smaller studies like ours, I would say the number of studies that you get is also the number of different methods of analyses that you will read about. So the reason we took this 3-stage approach is that we were actually, well, blessed with a very high number of methylation sites when we analyzed with the 3 individual methods. So to cut down the number of hits and to increase the robustness, we then figured that we might as well take the methylation sites that would emerge in all 3 methods separately and then look if there were such sites. And we luckily, we found 5 to 6 of such sites, and one of them was the PenX gene.
And Mingyu, if you could talk about this too, because I think this is really important for a young field to talk about methods and appropriate interpretation. And I would be very interested in hearing your take on appropriate ways to actually interrogate the epigenetic changes.
Yes, that is a very important issue. And I agree with what Rudolf said in general. There isn't a sort of gold standard method for analyzing genome scale methylation data. So I think the question actually has several levels. There are questions about what's the best wet lab technique to analyze methylation, which I think is not what we're discussing here. I think we're talking more about how to analyze the data that we get. And so in that sense, the view of epigenomic analysis is somewhat like the whole field of genomic analysis. It is evolving very rapidly, and new methods for analyzing data come out almost every month. For people who are just starting to do this kind of work, my suggestion would be to really look at the state of the art and where the field is now, and avoid having to go through the process of optimization on their own when other people have worked out some of the issues. And so focus on what the state of the art is and start go from there, but still recognize that even the state of the art methods are certainly not perfect.
So there we have it. What you eat during pregnancy, both as mothers and fathers, and importantly, what you eat before pregnancy does matter. And dietary deprivations can have a heritable impact on offspring, potentially for generations, and could help to bring the concept of precision medicine to a common reality. So I look forward to the next chapter in this exciting story of epigenetic influences on blood pressure and vascular regulation.
You've been listening to an AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology podcast. For more podcasts like this, visit us online at ajpheart.physiology.org. Thank you.